has everything, even if he doesn't have anything else. And the one who has everything apart from you has nothing. So this is the type of contentment that a believer needs to slowly and gradually achieve, whereby everything he gets just because he is with God. Being with God is enough for that person. When that person is in remembrance of God, because he knows that he is with God, he's happy and he's content. So that ontological restriction that he has, he needs to turn it to an opportunity to achieve that state of contentment. We need to use these material and constrictions and restrictions that happen in our lives to bring about the change that is needed in our souls and our hearts.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when we talk about this issue of this, you know, ontological or existential constriction or restriction that a person might have in his life, this is a very important place where a person needs to build that issue of contentment, that good quality of contentment in the heart. Another example that we have from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam is that Imam says that if nothing in the world was there apart from the Quran, I wouldn't be feeling alienated or scared or alone. I wouldn't feel bad. You see, the Quran is enough for me. This is a slowly that state that we need to achieve. And this is a state where you are pleased with the will of God. In a way, being pleased with the will of God is together kind of with the state of contentment. But now, of course, we will come to later on to explain that this state of contentment or this quality of contentment doesn't mean that a person does not perform actions with effort, or he should lose all his effortfulness, you know, and his desire to progress. These things have to be explained very well. We need to understand them very well. It doesn't mean that. Being content doesn't mean being lazy. Being content means being pleased when the possibility of being to do something greater is not there, either because of a legislative restriction or because of an ontological restriction. But if these restrictions, the ontological and the legislative restrictions, are not there, anything that would be anything positive that would lead to perfection is something that we need to work hard towards. So this is a very important criterion that I've mentioned today, inshallah. And let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we work hard, of course, but at the same time be content. Be content with the will of God, with what God has decided in all senses, but progress in what God has permitted us and what will cause us to reach higher in the general perfection that we have and other human beings have. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss India-Pakistan border clashes.
Kashmir is one of the hottest flashpoints of the world. And with every clash or confrontation, it is getting dangerously closer to igniting a full-fledged nuclear war. The Muslim-majority Himalayan region is held by India and Pakistan in parts, but claimed by both countries in full, except for a small sliver that is controlled by China. There are Indian-administered and Pakistani-administered Kashmirs, but none of the two governments, nor the residents, can live with the status quo.
The latest bout of border battles between Pakistan and India took place in mid-November. Artillery and machine gun clashes were reported all along the 740-kilometer ceasefire line that has separated the nuclear-armed rivals for the past 70 years, the so-called Line of Control, LOC. Pakistan and India, as usual, accuse each other for initiating the fight that killed about 15 people and wounded many more on both sides. Kashmiri villagers describe the skirmishes as the worst and most widespread they had witnessed in months. Denouncing the attack as unprovoked and indiscriminate, the Pakistani military and government said Indian rockets and mortar shells in various sectors along the line of control killed 4 Pakistani civilians and 1 soldier and wounded 27, including women and children.
It's a serious escalation. We have given them a very befitting reply. There have been massive losses on Indian side in men and material.
In Srinagar, the capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir, the Indian military told a different story, saying they foiled an infiltration attempt following suspicious movement in multiple sectors along the line of control. The army said 6 civilians, 3 soldiers and a border guard were killed, while several other people were wounded on their side.
India's allegations of intrusion are vehemently rejected by Pakistan, who says that these attacks are a part of New Delhi's consistent attempts to escalate the situation along the line of control. Pakistan believes that it is India that keeps violating international agreements, saying that India had committed more than 2,700 ceasefire violations since the beginning of the year 2020, killing 25 people and causing serious injuries to more than 200 civilians.
The latest incident happened a day after Pakistan summoned an Indian diplomat to protest what it called India's violation of a 2003 ceasefire agreement. 2 civilians were wounded on the Pakistani side of the border in that exchange. Sardar Masood Khan, the leader of the Pakistani-administered Kashmir, has urged the United Nations and the international community to help solve the issue, warning of a wider conflict. He said that if such hostilities are not stopped, it will be difficult to stop a war between Pakistan and India. The UN says it investigates alleged ceasefire violations complaints in a timely fashion within the constraints of a difficult operating terrain, practically stalling any move toward any resolution. Reiterating that the situation at the line of control remains tense and unpredictable, a UN peacekeeping spokesperson told Newsweek that the mandate by the UN Military Observer Group in India and Pakistan has lapsed since the signing of the Simla Agreement of 1972. About a year after the Bangladesh Liberation War that transformed into the Indo-Pakistani War of 1971, then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi and President Zulfikar Ali Bhutto signed a treaty to put an end to the conflict and confrontation and settle their differences by peaceful means through bilateral negotiations.
Now, for more analysis, we are joined by Mr. Anil Chugunayath. He's a former Indian senior diplomat and an ambassador. And Mr. Abdullah Khan, the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Gentlemen, welcome to the subcontinent. So, let's start in India. Mr. Chugunayath, from time to time we see clashes between India and Pakistan on the Kashmir border. Why is that? And what's needed to stop the conflict?
Well, it's a historic question. As you know that when India achieved its independence, defeat the British in 1947, the country was divided between the two. And we used to have more than 590 states, princely states. So they were given the option to join India or Pakistan. Now the Kashmiri king who was there, Hari Singh, he decided to join India. And then the Pakistanis sent their forces at that time when both the countries were trying to grapple with the thing. And they sent the Mujahids and all that to fight and occupied a large tract of the territory. And since then the people intervened, and this has remained a problem. Now, as you know, that if you go by the 26th October 1948 agreement, it is very clear that the Kashmir has become a part of India because they legally acceded to India, whereafter the Indian forces helped them detract the Pakistani Mujahids and Mujahideens and all those people who had come to fight and tribals and all. Since then, India and Pakistan have fought several wars. Now, at one time, it was referred to the United Nations in the beginning, and then it was decided in 1972 with the Shimla Accord that both the countries will decide all their issues, including Kashmir, through bilateral negotiations. Now, Pakistan off and on continues to talk, and then what happened is that Pakistan, in order to achieve its objectives, it has started using terrorism as a state policy, and that has created the biggest problem and a hiatus in the relationship. We have had wars in 1965, we have had wars 71 again in 1999. So since Kashmir is part of India, we had recently abrogated the Article 370 so that the Kashmiris can get the benefit of India's democratic development and the development generally, and applicability of all the laws that apply within the Indian state. But what Pakistan has done on the contrary, in 1963, they ceded a part of the territory that they had occupied to China. Imagine now, apart from the fact that they themselves were illegally occupying it, they had also sent it to, given it to China. And now recently, Gilgit Baltistan, they have tried to make a part of their state of their country. Now, that is again illegal. So I believe that only option for us is to work together, and Pakistan has to contain the terrorism, because today it is not Kashmir which is the real issue. The real issue actually is Pakistan's use of terrorism against India.
All right, Mr. Tugunayat. So, Mr. Khan, our guest in New Delhi says that Kashmir is not the issue. What do you think is the issue and how can it be solved?
First of all, by claiming that Kashmir is not an issue and the terrorism or anything else is the issue, it is an attempt to actually hide sun behind your finger. We all know that the main reason, the root cause of unrest in Kashmir is the Kashmir issue, their right of self-determination. And that is the key. And unless that issue is resolved, the issue of violence in Kashmir, we call it freedom struggle, the Indians call it terrorism or whatever they can say, Atangwad or whatever they use the terminology, the basic root cause is actually the right of the people of Kashmir, the right of self-determination. And I would like to tell you that what the Indian claim that instrument of accession, which they can never and they had never and they can never produce in the front of the international community, the original instrument of accession, because they actually forced the Maharaja, because when he was under pressure by the unrest going on in Gilgit Baltistan and parts of Kashmir, so India actually had entered its forces well before the so-called instrument of accession. But before that instrument of accession, the Maharaja had signed a standstill agreement with Pakistan. The state of Jammu and Kashmir had become part of Pakistan since partition in 1947. And then it was India which took it to the UN Security Council. And it was India's repeated pledges that India will allow people of Jammu and Kashmir to exercise their right of self-determination. Now, all of a sudden saying that this is not an issue, the issue is terrorism, please address the root cause. What you asked, why the clashes are going on, I would like to say that since India last year forcefully, illegally annexed Kashmir and made it part of the Indian territory, now they are trying to actually occupy Azad Kashmir, which is the part which is administered by Pakistan. So they are now actually trying to do some nefarious design against Pakistan in Azad Kashmir and Gilgit-Baltistan, and that is the reason Pakistan is trying to expel them. And we should actually look at what the UN says. As per the international law, all the bilateral agreements are superseded by the international commitments of countries. So India and Pakistan both have committed that the Kashmir will be resolved as per the UN Security Council resolutions. So our Indian friends are generally confusing international community with their stances which cannot be supported by legal argument. So the basic fact is, and what the resolution is, and as you asked, how this can be stopped, that can only be stopped when the Kashmir issue will be resolved as per the wishes of the people of Kashmir. And that is the key, actually.
Thank you, gentlemen. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this segment, and good discussion.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Since they gained independence, New Delhi and Islamabad have fought four wars. In 1948, 1965, 1971, and 1991, three of these wars have been over Kashmir. Tensions soared in February 2019 when Pakistan shot down an Indian warplane in Kashmir and captured a pilot in response to an airstrike by Indian aircraft targeting militants inside Pakistan. India said that strikes targeted Pakistan-based militants responsible for a suicide bombing that killed 40 Indian troops in the Indian-controlled part of Kashmir. But the airstrike killing the militants is largely disputed by the international media and site inspectors.
India's cooperation with the United Nations Military Observer Group in India and Pakistan was further urged in a letter sent by Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi to the UN Security Council. The Pakistani top diplomat's letter came ahead of Prime Minister Imran Khan's virtual address to the UN General Assembly. For a second year in a row, the Pakistani leader spoke at length about alleged abuses on the Indian-administered side of Kashmir and warned of potential war, calling on the UN Security Council to step in to prevent a disastrous conflict by implementing resolutions.
Mr. President, there will be no durable peace and stability in South Asia until the Jammu and Kashmir dispute is resolved on the basis of international legitimacy. Kashmir has been rightly described as a nuclear flashpoint.
Indian diplomat Mijito Vinito, the first in New Delhi's UN mission, who walked out of the room during Khan's speech, later insisted on his country's right to the region and asked Pakistan to leave Kashmir.
The Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir is an integral and inalienable part of India. The only dispute left in Kashmir relates to that part of Kashmir that is still under illegal occupation of Pakistan. We call upon Pakistan to vacate all those areas that it is in illegal occupation of.
In his own speech that same day, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi did not bring up the issue of Kashmir.
While leaving the subcontinent, the British enabled a division of the country on religious grounds, with the Muslim-dominated regions becoming a part of Pakistan and others staying a part of India. As per the partition formula, Kashmir could have gone to Pakistan as was expected by the Pakistani leadership. But the Hindu king was not ready to make an immediate decision and signed a standstill agreement with Pakistan to keep the flow of trade, communication and travel. The whole bloody affair may have been started by the UK, but the US role in fueling the flames of conflict seem undeniable.
The recent skirmishes in Kashmir serve as a momentous warning to the entire world, as a similar rivalry is simmering between India and China in another part of the Himalayas, on the backdrop of a global coronavirus pandemic and a messy post-election United States. As the world's most likely venue for a nuclear war, Kashmir is a contentious issue for Washington's foreign policy, since the US is deeply involved with both countries and stuck between them. The US needs its long-term partner, India, to play a supporting role in blunting China's increasing rise. At the same time, Washington heavily relies on Pakistan as an essential player in the negotiations with Taliban to conclude decades of America's war in Afghanistan. The US donates billions of dollars to both countries annually and has tried a wide array of strategies, but everything turns out to be ultimately in vain. It cannot make India reconsider its often heavy-handed management of Jammu and Kashmir that inspires more militancy. And it also cannot make Pakistan change its policy of negligence about the supposedly banned groups that operate against New Delhi. Given the prospects and perils of the escalating fight for Kashmir, the global community does not afford to feign ignorance and remain indifferent, as the planet may be approaching to the precipice of a disaster.
All right, so in the previous segment, we heard from our guests in India and Pakistan. Now let's bring in a Kashmiri voice and talk to Mr. Rafiq Katwari. He's a Kashmiri activist and commentator. Mr. Katwari, welcome to the show. Time and time again, we hear about these clashes between India and Pakistan. What do you think is the source of these conflicts?
Time and again, the present regime in New Delhi has been propagating to its diehard Hindutva followers that Pakistan is the source of all that ails India, that Pakistan is the enemy. This is a deflection, and it plays well on the 24/7 news channels, where the anchors are the definition of jingoism. And most of these 24/7 news channels are owned by arms merchants who are actually agents of the global arms industry, and India is a big market these days, or at least used to be a couple of years ago, for the arms market. Now, during the last 6 or 7 years that the BJP regime, the Bharatiya Janata Party regime, has been in power, India's economy has declined drastically. These clashes are really, at the moment, a deflection by Mr. Modi, because India's economy is in dire straits.
Mr. Katwari, you earlier said that the reason why all this is happening is because the Indian economy is in dire straits. So what is the ultimate solution for Kashmir?
And the ultimate solution, the most democratic solution, is self-determination. Okay, respecting the wishes of the people. Now, if the powers that be wanted that to happen, it could happen within 48 hours. If there is a will, there is a way. India and Pakistan are nuclear nations. The road to peace in South Asia, in fact, the road to a just solution of the Kashmir dispute and a just peace in Afghanistan, is through Kashmir. Either you build a bridge holding hands with the Kashmiri people, or you build a bridge over the Kashmiri people. But for God's sake, build something. Don't destroy the societies. Don't destroy people. Don't destroy their hope, just as India has done over the past over 1 year, when it abolished Kashmir's limited autonomy and people lived by symbols. We had our own flag. That was taken away from us. We were reduced from a state of the Indian Union to a union territory. And now what has set in over the last 1 year in a very hurried way is what you would call the Israeli model, what Israel has been doing in Palestine, India is now in a very accelerated way doing in Kashmir. Apple trees are being chopped away just as olive trees have been chopped away. Children are being arrested. People are being put in jails for no apparent reason, especially given the COVID situation. Laws are being changed. Demographics are being changed. So we are back to what has happened to Palestine is now, of course, being copied by India. But again, I just want to assure your viewers and I want to assure myself that, you know, Modi's come and Modi's go, and inshallah, we will one day learn to how to deal with all this situation. Because, we will get what is due to us and India will get its karma.
All right. The ultimate solution is self-determination. Thank you so much, Mr. Katwari, for being with us and sharing your opinions. It was nice having you with us. Let's see how people on social media see this situation.
By posting painting drawn by a Kashmiri student, Adhar Parvaiz tries to portray the sorrow of the people of Kashmir. Jai Kamath believes that removal of the Article 370 by BJP was just a tool to further oppress the Kashmiris, while most parts of India don't care about them. In this tweet, Safina Nabi shares her observations of the situation of South Kashmir and criticizes the government for its actions in the region. This one is a short video which has recently gone viral, showing how the military forces treat a journalist from India today.
Sir, yeh attack jo highway pe ho.
Referring to the previous post, Tusif Wani expressed concern about the situation of local journalists and how the military forces treat them. And Tony Ashayi also opines that the resistance of the people against oppression will eventually lead to the negotiation of the oppressors with the oppressed.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode covering the Indian-Pakistan border clashes along the line of control in Kashmir. We'll meet next week.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have my favorite guest, sister and expert, Sister Razia Shamani. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
On our show, we've been discussing very interesting and eye-opening topic. We've been rediscussing it, actually, in a very interesting and eye-opening method. Mm-hmm. It's the topic of haya, modesty, which, fascinatingly enough, you have reintroduced to us all, putting it in a way that brought us to a new understanding in regard with this term. And that haya isn't necessarily something that is limited to women, and it does not mean shyness, it does not mean not being confident about who you are in your own skin. Rather, it means self-worth, it means dignity.
Something that decreases your haya is intoxication. A couple of days ago, I was talking to a friend of mine, and she was saying that in one country that she went, the alcoholic beverages site was completely blocked down, and people were not allowed to buy any alcoholic beverages. This friend of mine was in Turkey, actually. Mm. But another friend of mine who said in restaurants in some parts of Europe, they previously used to serve alcoholic beverages, they don't do it anymore because in the Corona pandemic, people who have alcoholic drinks, they have less inhibition.
Mm.
And with less inhibition, you know, things that this part of you that you would reserve usually, once you have this alcohol, you reveal it more to people. Mm. You become more closely to people.
Yeah.
Less haya.
Less so social distancing.
Exactly.
MashaAllah.
Isn't it amazing?
Ladies and gentlemen, seriously. When are we going to take this seriously?
I love this.
And it makes sense because we explain how haya and intellect are almost the same thing. The higher a person's intellect, the more they value themselves, the more they would abstain from doing degrading things.
Exactly.
And what alcohol does, it switches off your intellect. And then everything else goes out of the window.
No intellect, no shame.
There we go. We're talking about haya. We can continue talking about it forever.
Because there are so many different aspects.
Exactly.
It's not just covering the body. It's about living a lifestyle.
It's a lifestyle.
Seriously, isn't it?
There we go.
It's linked with mindfulness, with gratitude, you know, with the way you verbal abuse, sympathy, empathy, whatever that comes to your mind in a research field, you could link it to haya.
Yeah, exactly. I'd say without exaggeration, it's one of the most noble human characteristics. The fact that sense of self-worth and integrity, that I am better than this, I am better than sin, I am better than corruption, I am better than promiscuity, I am better than profanity. It's so encouraging, you know?
Yeah.
It's so empowering.
That is such a beautiful terminology. It is so empowering rather than intimidating.
Exactly.
Or, you know, keep up your self-esteem, keep up your self-confidence. You can do it. Show yourself. Show everybody who you are.
Yeah.
Exactly.
If you've got a flaunted sort of mindset.
Yeah.
And I think this would be... This collection of episode would be a great answer to all those feminists out there that say being modest is a degrading attribute for women because it makes them shy away from mm-hmm. being noticed and being ambitious and doing whatever it is that they want to do. We just explained that not only is haya not exclusive to women, it's a human thing, but it is your best way to be the best version of yourself.
And to empower.
Exactly, and to empower you.
Women, especially women.
Women, exactly. And the fact that Allah says women are gifted more with haya, doesn't that kind of mean that women are worth more? Doesn't it kind of mean we're more valuable? Come on.
Yeah, actually some scholars believe that there's a better way for women. It's more convenient or easier for women to gain to reach the lofty status of perfection because of the attributes, the feminine attributes that Allah Subhanahu wa Ta'ala has gifted them.
Exactly.
Unlike many scholars who say that
it's impossible for women.
Yeah, because they're not qasal uqul, you know, they have their impaired minds, you know, they have problem thinking and reasoning and whatever.
They're hormonal and they can't even pray half their lives.
Exactly. So because of this, men are, you know, they have more potential to become perfect human beings. But when you
there's
see
actually
that
a hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam where His Eminence says, and I love this hadith so much, and I've repeated it a kajillion times on my Instagram, and I've flaunted it to the universe. His Holiness says, أكثر الخير في النساء.
Wow.
Most of goodness is within women.
Isn't this fabulous?
It is fabulous.
SubhanAllah, such a beautiful religion that esteems and honors and dignifies women to this extent.
Exactly.
Remember that in the previous part, we said that Shaitan promised that he would tempt human beings and la'ughviyannahum, right?
Yes.
So we have to take into consideration that based on the verses of the Noble Quran, this could happen, this temptation, this being trialed in a specific way to be tempted by Shaitan could happen only if you want it to happen.
What does that mean?
Because in the Noble Quran, it says, إِنَّا جَعَلْنَا الشَّيْطَانَ أَوْلِيَاءَ لِلَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ لَا إِكْرَاهَ فِي الدِّينِ. You can choose to be a believer or a non-believer. But then, if you're a non-believer, whatever happens to you, it's your own fault. You pay the price of your decision. There was a psychologist saying that when I want to say something to my son, like he says, Dad, can I go to this party my friends are throwing? And he says, you can go if you want, but I am not going to let you. But still, if you want to go, it's your choice. If you go, you're going to pay for the consequences.
Okay.
So there are two choices. Either that you stay,
yeah,
and you can have my consent and
my satisfaction
with you, and you can have whatever bonuses that you want. Or you can go, but it's not with my permission.
Uh-huh.
And you will pay for the consequences.
Interesting.
You see, the same story is here.
Exactly.
You cannot have faith in God. You're free. But then the consequence is that your awliya, your guardians, your torch of path in life will be the shayateen, the Satans.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
Again, in another verse of the Noble Quran, in the famous verse of Ayatul Kursi in chapter Baqarah,
yes.
Allahu waliyul ladina aman. So it depends who you put your trust in. Isn't it beautiful?
It is.
Everything is so simple, but yet it becomes very challenging.
Yeah, it's
in the
simple,
trials of
but
life.
It's not easy. Oh, no, it's not easy
it's
at all.
It's very, very difficult.
Young butterfly.
So let me just translate it. It says, Allah is the guardian of those who believe. He brings them out of the darkness into the light. And this is verse 257 of Baqarah. We already have talked about a lot of the manifestations of Haya. We're just going to review them all together as one group. We have it in the Noble Quran in the beautiful story of Qasas, chapter Al-Qasas, verses number 23 to 25, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings this fabulous story into a picture where there are sheep, flocks of sheep, different shepherds, and there are two lady shepherds where...
with their herd.
With their herd, and there is water, and they are not going forward to mingle with the men. You know, now being a shepherd, it's a male kind of
job,
but back then it the daughters
of
the prophet.
And they had an old dad. Their dad was old.
Yeah, you know, maybe they had to do it. Yeah, as you said,
exactly.
their father was old. So they were doing this job, but they were reserving the boundaries of haya at the same time that they were working. So you can see sometimes it's possible to do a male job. I mean... if you have to do it,
exactly.
If you're in certain conditions that you have to do it. But it doesn't mean that once you do that job, you have to cross the lines. You can still have preserve those lines, the red
lines. Still hold your own value and your boundaries as a woman. And I think that's so beautiful the way you said. By the way, we kept our promise, ladies and gentlemen. I know, like... 6 episodes ago, our expert promised us this story about one of the most beautiful instances of haya in the Quran in relation with the daughters of a prophet of Allah. They were shepherd ladies, and they had a herd, and there was a well, and a lot of other men were watering their herds there, and the women stayed back.
And actually, there was no gentleman saying ladies first.
Exactly.
But there was one gentleman. He has been brought up in the palace.
Palace.
And he's a prince. So this gentleman comes along approaches the girls and asks for the reason why they're standing back, and they say because of the man, and he does the job for them.
And waters their
herd. Waters the flock. And then the girls, they were also very noble ladies. As a sign of showing appreciation, they invite him. He said, we have an old father, you know, he would like to show his appreciation to you, and they invite him to join them. And here again, we have another beautiful instance of haya, that they weren't, you know, walking in a way to attract attention. Mm. And the Noble Quran specifically mentions the manner of walking of this noble lady, that
prophet.
It says, فَجَاءَتْهُ إِهْدَاهُمَا تَمْشِي أَلَسْتَهِيَا. I love this verse so much.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. So then here, we have instances of verses in the Noble Quran talking about hijab of body parts. We even had that in the verse that was talking about women and men guarding their eyes and not to stare at, you know, each other. And at the end of the verse regarding women, because women are the epitome of beauty and delicacy and femininity, they have something treasurable that they have to only show it to unique people.
Yeah, exactly. So that would value them.
Exactly. And that would style their life in a way that would give them more peace of mind.
Mm.
You know, give them the shelter of a home, of a family.
Unfortunately, it hurts and aches my heart to say that we are out of time for today's episode of Muslim Lady. Until another segment, we leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female, and made us into nations and tribes, so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history, just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
کسانی میتونن خوب عمل کنن اهل رشدن
Only those are able to act righteously and grow spiritually who do all their deeds according to faith, right deed, and frequent remembrance of Allah. Now, this criterion is true about all professions, even art and poetry. In other words, their art and poetry must be in accordance with Islamic teachings. If the works produced by artists and poets are godly, then they will grow in terms of spirituality and divinity. Such artists are no more misguided or deceived and have a high status. As a result, the followers of such artistic works are grown spiritually too, and they will be guided into the right path. Therefore, if you want to know who in the eyes of Allah is higher than others, whether it be a poet or artist, it is he who hath faith in Allah, do righteous deeds, and remembers Allah in every moment of his life.
ایمان و عمل صالح و ذکر الله الکثیر بیان میکنیم.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khalav Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Khalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Inside Israel.
The year 2020 is coming to an end. For Israel, it was a year of crises, from the political deadlock, which many argue is still ongoing, to the continuous anti-regime protests. Tel Aviv has had a lot on its plate. What are the protesters protesting? Well, every crisis Israel is in. First and foremost, they want an end to the coalition regime led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They also want the regime to finally pass a 2020 budget. Yes, that's right. Israel has yet to pass a 2020 budget, impacting many Israelis.
This thing against the Prime Minister was involved in the 3 accusations. He should resign immediately, in my opinion, because the way the country goes, it's the wrong direction.
The latest NGO group says this is impacting many Israelis. The group says that over 20% of Israelis are living in poverty, and hundreds of thousands of children don't have meals to eat at home. That was in 2019. According to Israel's latest, that number shot up about 50% this year.
So now we are facing winter. And I personally know people who sometimes sit at home with 3 blankets because they're afraid to turn on the heating because they're concerned that they won't have enough money to pay electricity, for example. So when you see in the society elderly people or children who live in severe food insecurity and poverty, you understand that this is not the right way. And we must morally and ethically and humanly, in terms of human and humanitarian approach, to take care of these vulnerable populations. The minimum wage is not high enough, so people who earn minimum wage also live in poverty. So this is one arena. We also need to invest in education, in housing, in the health system, that more people invest private money if they have to get better health treatment. But if you don't have money, so sometimes you won't get the right treatment, or if you don't have money at all, you won't buy medicine, for example, because you need to pay the house rent and so on. So the some examples is, for example, to increase the minimum wage, and also the allocations that the government give to families with children or to elderly people. I'll give you an example. If you're an elderly people in Israel and you don't have pension, and you relate only on the government allocation, you will live in a poor situation. I mean, you will be poor. So this is something that we must change, because elderly people cannot go to work. And if they rely only on the governmental aid, it must make them live in dignity.
Israel had to have a third election in April just to form a coalition cabinet. Even then, Israel was going for a fourth election. The political deadlock in Israel is taking its toll on the economy, policies, and society, as the current caretaker cabinet is limited in its ability to enact concrete policies. The situation has become so bad that there is a butter crisis, where shoppers cannot find butter due to an acute butter shortage that has been blamed on Israel's political deadlock. The regime has yet to pass a budget for 2020. According to the latest NGO, there are 2.3 million Israelis living in poverty, but that figure is up 50%, latest claims. The other is by National Insurance Institute, which reported that the elderly and children are most vulnerable. Things are going for the worst too. Earlier this year, Israel's economy has entered the biggest recession since Israel was incepted onto Palestinian lands in 1948. According to the OECD, Israel's debt-to-GDP ratio is expected to be 75% this year and rise to 88% in 2022. Moreover, 20% of the Israeli working population is unemployed. With two lockdowns because of the coronavirus and a third one looming, Israeli workers and business owners are angry. Small business owners even went on a strike and led a rebellion against regime orders to lockdown. To make matters even worse, the political deadlock seems to be ongoing, as yet a fourth election in less than 2 years also looms in Israel.
The problem is that many budgets, such particularly for old people, for children who need help in terms of development or things of the sort, so these budgets that normally would be extended or added, these budgets are basically frozen. So as a result, you can see quite a few programs that are frozen and population that do not receive the social conditions that they were expecting to get. Many people vote for parties that they are not really excited about, only because they want to maintain the government or replace the government, even though they do it out of desperation, because they see that there's no significant leadership in the future. Netanyahu, who was very effective in the beginning, over the time he became exhausted. And the Netanyahu that we have today is exhausted, is not effective. All he does is cling to his political situation and fight the legal system that is working against him. So many people are really frustrated because the current government is not effective and the alternative is not serious. So we really feel that we are living in a vacuum.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Yuri says Netanyahu deprives Israel of its annual budget, forcing hundreds of thousands of citizens into economic chaos, unemployment, and poverty. We will not give up. According to Ali, in Israel, poverty rate for Jews is about 15%, while for Arab citizens is over 50%. Just like Canada's settler-native divide. Liberty and Justice for All says that's why they receive more financial aid than any